Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is part of our ongoing coverage of the Casey Anthony trial. Joining me in the studio is my wife, Jan. She is battling the flu or a cold or something, but has agreed to soldier on. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Simon. Hello, everyone.
We also have a wonderful panel joining us today. From up in New York, we have the crime doctor himself, Denny Griffin. Denny, great to talk to you again.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. It's a pleasure to be back with you, and looking forward to the show.
And from the City of Angels, we have veteran trial lawyer Manny Barling. Manny, it is always delightful to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I'll bet. I'm not sure if he's with us yet, but from the lobster hub of the universe, the state of Maine, we're expecting statement analysis guru Peter Hyatt. Peter, are you with us yet?
Tis himself. I'm here.
Splendid. How are you doing, Peter?
Oh, great. I'm glad you invited me back. I missed being on the program. So I hope, Jan, hope you're feeling better.
So did you come on today to give us some barbecue tips from the holiday?
No, but I did have a wonderful Texas barbecue thanks to some of the tips I received from you all. It was a lot of fun.
And from Ground Zero, Orlando, Florida, we have Orlando Magazine writer, Dave Knackle. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Simon. Hello, everyone. Right here at Ground Zero. Yep, here I am.
Dave, I have to ask you this. Is there any truth in the vicious rumor that you're suffering from a bad case of numb bum from sitting in the courtroom all week?
Yeah, you know, a little bit, but I'll tell you, it's a lot better than it was in the hearings. The hearings toward the tail end of the case were before the trial started, of course, were held in courtroom 19D, and that's like a church pew, you know, solid wood and not comfortable at all. So sitting there for hours is a lot worse than sitting in these seats, which are padded. I can't complain.
And of course, no program would be complete without the always colorful bail bondsman, William Cobra Storbs. Cobra, welcome to the program.
Hey, Simon. Good to hear you up there chatting away. And Jan, and hope you had a good birthday party, Jan, and all my other friends on there. And Peter, been a while. I want you to radio check Mr. Manny, Mr. Peter. I think the feller's holding back some secrets.
Of course I am.
Okay. As always, our chat room is open, and we do invite listeners to ask their questions in there, but play nicely. Don't be rude to each other. Okay. Before we get started, there's just a couple of quick notes. Long-time listeners of this program will remember our coverage concerning a missing Pearl River man, Zachary Pittman. It was with a heavy heart, or it is with a heavy heart, but I have to confirm that human remains were found not very far from where he was living, and dental records show that they are indeed Zachary Pittman. We're waiting for his mother, Christy Ragus, to contact us again. I know that she's been somewhat tied up with the coroners and the police. But, you know, we will be updating the case when we have more information. I'm sure I speak for everyone in, sending sympathies to Christy and the entire family. Very sad indeed. On a lighter note, I was contacted by an author friend of mine yesterday, someone with the unlikely name of Gaston Delos Dandro. It's not his real name. I mean, that's his nom de guerre. He has been following our coverage of the Casey Anthony story and has given me a copy of his book and two Kindle versions that he would like to give away to our listeners. More on that later in the week when I figure out what we're going to do. Okay, on with the program. Dave, I'm going to start with you because you're the guy with the numb bum sitting in the courtroom. It seems to me that the prosecution started the week strong. Even much of the video evidence was riveting stuff. It vicariously placed Casey on the stand. What did you think? You know, prosecution doing a good job so far?
Oh, I think the prosecution should be commended for all their work. I mean, they're putting this into a, it's a timeline of events. And with each passing moment, they have something to contribute regarding Casey's, I guess, I don't want to just say guilt, but everything alludes to her, for sure, to her guilt. So, yeah, I think that the state is doing a remarkable job.
What about you, Peter? I know that you've been following it fairly closely. Are you impressed with the prosecution so far?
I am. I think they've done an incredible job. The one thing I've noticed after the initial cross of George Anthony, the redirect of George Anthony, was that they're not changing their strategy. They're staying the course. They're methodically building a very powerful case. Simon, I'm impressed. They have been quiet for 3 years. They've done their homework. They've come prepared. I think at times they're, at least Ashton perhaps, is not raising objections to things that he could object, especially when Baez goes outside of scope, because Baez is serving the prosecution needs so well. So this has been everything I think that Cobra said it was going to be. This is an amazing drama that's out before our eyes. Incredible.
Well, what about you, Manny? Weigh in from the legal eagle standpoint. Do you think the prosecution is scoring big points at the moment?
Well, I don't think they're scoring big points. I agree with the analysis. They're walking steadily down the path of their case, undaunted by their defense, which is what they should do, because I come back to the same position. The main issue with this case is how to explain the period of time in which she was missing, and really this is the only issue in the case the defense must win if they expect to exonerate their client. So the prosecution knows the defense has to walk down the same road of the 30 days and ask questions, so all they're doing is baiting them into what I would call exposing the weaknesses of their case. So I think they're doing an excellent job of it. And the most important thing when you put on a case, it's sort of like John Wooden's theory of basketball. Don't worry about the other side. Just do what you do best and ignore them. Because if you do what you do best, you will win 99% of the time. And that's what the prosecution's doing.
Well, what about you, Denny? Do you think that, the prosecution is taking the correct approach, this methodical timeline, thump, thump, thump?
Yeah, and I agree with what's been said by everybody else so far. They seem to be very methodical, very organized. They see the goalposts. They know where they are. They know how they need to get to those goalposts. and they're going on undaunted by the especially the opening statement. Some commentators and the talking heads on the TV programs after that opening statement were saying, oh, my God, it's going to be burning the midnight oil in the prosecutor's office tonight. They got to revamp the case to respond to Baez. And apparently they're not. They know what they've got. They know how they want to present it, and they know where they want to be at the end of the day, and they're going that direction. So, I think they're doing a nice job, not the tremendous bombshell-type stuff and smoking gun and all that kind of thing, but the progression is nice and steady, and they seem to be, what do they call it, weaving the mosaic? I think that's what they're doing.
Well, Cobra, you usually have some colorful comment at a point like this. how would you rate the prosecution's case?
Well, they were doing pretty dadgum good. Baez held his own, of course, until they put the FBI forensics person on the stand last couple of days. And I think they're spelling the word hair wrong. I don't think they're using the H-A-I-R. I think they're using H-A-R-E-I-N, rabbit, and watching Baez pull one out his ass. And the thing of it is I think Baez did a stellar job, and I don't care much for the man, but I think he did a very stellar job, steadily took her apart piece by piece. And I think that when these issues come back around, see, a lot of people wonder why this isn't brought up and that's not brought up. We have to understand that the prosecution has opened the case, and the only thing the defense can do at this time is argue and debate what they bring up. They can't bring in or introduce new stuff, and what about this, if the prosecution did bring it out. So I think that stand by, because when they rest and Baez takes over, he's got that little shit-eating grin going on, and I do believe he did a very stellar job, and he held his own against that lady. And I don't know if Peter was watching, but her body language is given away. He was at her pretty intensely. She was just hoping to God could she get off that stand in a very short matter. And apparently it was all over this rabbit trick they were trying to do, over this one hair when, you know, anybody watched it, I think he took her apart quite well.
Oh, okay. I'm going to come back to the hair.
Be careful with the hair situation. You know, I'm kind of like... very sensitive when it comes to hair.
Just right. Don't pull one out of your ass. Hey, what was it? Pull a rabbit out of my hat?
No, it's more that a CSI evidence collector would have some problems getting hair samples from Dave Nichols.
Follically challenged.
Going to the lower regions on him.
Yeah, don't go there.
Okay, I want to wind back to the early part of the week. Everyone sat with bated breath when it was announced that Lee Anthony was going to be put on the stand. And I'll be honest with you, I thought he was a huge disappointment to the prosecution. He appeared to be completely unprepared. Jan, I know you have a sore throat, but do you concur?
I think he was torn. Didn't want to say nothing against his sisters, and he didn't want to say nothing against his parents. I think he just... I do think he was a disappointment. I think that they expected more from him, but didn't get it.
Keep in mind, he's a rebuttal witness. Just keep that in mind. He's the lifesaver that's coming when the defense
exactly.
opens. Yep.
Dave, would you agree with that comment?
Well, you know, I think it was, what was it, last August that... the state gave an opportunity to be deposed again, and you better tell the truth this time or else. And, you know, he did go in and tell the prosecution something because he wasn't charged with anything. But I think in the courtroom he was almost, to me, almost like a deer caught in headlights. I don't think, you know, who was it just said a few minutes ago that he came prepared, but I mean, how do you really prepare yourself to testify other than really to testify to the truth? But I don't think he really lied about anything. I mean, I didn't see him as being so much of a detriment to the state as you know, some of you think he is. I mean, he didn't testify for his sister, you know.
Okay, Peter, you obviously watched Lee's performance, and what's your opinion?
I agree with the comments that preceded mine, beginning with Jan. Jan said that he appeared to be almost unwilling to make a decision who he wanted to support, his sister or the truth, and his memory lapses were deceptive. He has no trouble with his memory, and I don't think it was so much that he was unprepared. I think he was undecided. I think that's the word that Jan used, undecided. And he was mildly deceptive, especially in the I don't remembers. But if I can go off topic just for a moment, Simon, I've taken up a challenge that people have been calling T.C. Anthony a great liar. And my contention is that she's not a great liar. She's a great performer. She has a lot of confidence in her lies, but she is not a great liar. In fact, she's very easy to discern. And so what I've done is I've taken all her linguistic, I've taken her linguistic code and I've broken it for people, and it's very simple. She has a couple of words that are very dear to her. And what, as we talk about those words, what you'll notice is that Lee uses them as well. And it's a form of hyperbole where when she finds anyone in agreement with her, she'll say, absolutely, exactly, precisely. And she uses it often. And I noticed that Lee was going towards that. And he didn't do it with the same type of confident emphasis that he has done in the past. And so this is where I jumped from Jan to Cobra. I think he was indecisive and didn't have a strong memory, but I think that he is going to be the defense's only witness outside of calling Casey herself, who may, I don't know if he will, lie in the attempt to save Casey's life. Is that what you were getting at, Cobra?
Yes, kind of. Like, I don't want to give up my next go-round by answering that question at the moment.
Okay.
Okay. I'm sorry.
All right. Manny, you're the only person on this panel that has a legal background. Now, if you were the prosecutor in any case, you know, doesn't have to be this one. You're going to stick a witness that you think is, you know, quote for you, or at least has useful information. Aren't you going to prep them a little bit? You know, tell them to read their statements, things like that.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't consider him a prosecution witness. He's a member of the family, and you can only really do that with witnesses on your side. So I don't think that his family would allow him to meet and prepare his testimony, you know, with the prosecutor without consequences. And I don't agree with some of the observations about him. He has a typical problem I've seen a lot of in my career. He's got a family that he may agree with or disagree with, but he also has to go home with them. So he's now faced with putting up testimony that he has to go home and live with, not today, tomorrow, but next year, the year after, and for the rest of his life. You know, the word torque, which appears more with cars, the twisting and distortion of things, well, I think that he is probably being torqued like someone with a wrench. That he sits there and he looks at his mother and his father, he looks at the looks on their faces and all the things that go with that. And I think it has a terrible effect on anyone. I certainly wouldn't want to be on it. And about veracity and truth, I have two children, a boy and a girl. Boy, I'd like to get them a degree on anything. And by the way, I might say that starting from the time they were born. I mean, boys and girls don't always agree. They don't always support each other. They don't always like what the other one does. So to say that he's automatically going to perjure himself for his sister implies some type of symbiotic Corsican sister type relationship. And I've seen very few of those in my life. I've seen quite the contrary, that the siblings will trash each other as quickly as anything else. And I think that's the fact that it's not being considered. But to answer your strategy question, the prosecution called him because of their concerns about who he's going to testify to later. They didn't care what he said at this particular proceeding. They just wanted to get him up there unexpectedly, be uncomfortable, look shaky, and have the jury look at him in a way that they controlled, not one that was controlled by the defense. Because if the defense puts him on, they're going to lead him around like an animal in a circus ring through questions carefully prepared, as you all suggest he should be, and then it becomes like a kabuki dance of orchestrated answers. Now the jury got a chance to see him when he was a little uncomfortable. He didn't quite know what he wanted to say. He was worried about his family reaction, all the things that I just described. So I think that's the strategy, and I personally like that strategy and have used it repeatedly throughout my career. It's called embarrass them before they look good for somebody else.
I don't like it. Jen, you obviously want to weigh in.
Yeah, well, I was going to say is that one reason that everybody says that about Lee is because of the fact that he made the statement. He believes everything that his sister said. And, I mean, he went along with everything that his sister ever said before this.
Well, what choice does he have? I mean, what's
well,
he going to do, stand up
beginning.
And...
No, this is from the beginning he has said this.
But I don't think he has a choice, Jan. He says that, or he suddenly... What if he says, you know, I'm not certain I believe my sister. God, how'd you like to talk to your parents after you made that statement? And I think that's what he's struggling with. He has to be so very cautious of what he says because of the politics of his own home.
I disagree, Manny. Manny, what's going to end up happening as it goes a little bit further, and I could be wrong, but he is going to throw them all under the bus because he will not forget the promise he made to see.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't
doubt
that either. But we're talking about today, Cobra, not what has to do when he's doing
what's
a full-blown
testimony. That's
going to
come. Right now, he can't, Manny, because the prosecution didn't lead him in that path. Once the defense puts on their side, then you're going to see, you said, you know, he has to go home. He doesn't ever give a shit about going back home. He's going to throw Cindy under the bus so bad, watch and see.
Well, I agree with you. When he's forced to, but he will be better off doing it under a scenario when he says, I didn't have a choice. Look what they did to me. I'm not an experienced witness.
No.
I just don't think he's going to do
waiting.
This voluntarily.
No, he's waiting for that. He's waiting for the opportunity. That's the promise that he made. He is waiting for that. He could not bring that out yet. Why do you think they didn't ask him? Nobody asked him about his ancestral behavior. The defense, they said, why the defense? The defense couldn't ask him anyway because the prosecution should bring it out. But the fact of the matter is he is the lion sitting back there waiting. This is not I had to. This is I want to. I want to save her. The most important one in the family is Casey. It is not Cindy, and he's going to throw Cindy under the bus and watch and see. I mean, bad, on his own volition. Not, he'll probably lead the question.
Oh, wait and see. That's so. That would be so out of character the way the witnesses behave. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, Denny, do you have any thoughts on Lee Anthony?
Yeah, I don't think he hurt the prosecution. I mean, they got a certain amount of information out of him. It was obvious to me pretty much from after he stated his name and got in the witness box that he wasn't going to volunteer a thing. The prosecution seemed to have to drag it out of him to make their point. And I tend to agree probably with what Cobra was saying, that maybe when he gets up there and Baez is leading the charge, maybe he's going to be a little more voluntary. Maybe he'll have an agenda that he wants to complete. But, you know, I don't think he was a total bust as prosecution witness, but I think he was very, whether it was indecisive or whether he has some other agenda, he didn't seem to be totally forthcoming to me.
Peter, what do you think Lee's agenda is? You know, is he the dark horse that's going to come out and bury Cindy as Cobra thing?
I have a tendency to think that he will. He hasn't given us any linguistic indicators because he stayed out of the spotlight for almost 3 years. But when he was still speaking, what he told us is that, A, he is a liar and lies with impunity. B, he was not only backing his sister, but he had some kind of involvement, and they supposedly the child was kidnapped, and he seemed giving her a high five and giggling, and his bizarre behavior at the memorial. I think he's dirty. I think he's dirty. I think that if that child's body was moved, there may be some involvement with the family. Not giving credence to Baez's defense, but I think that there was something that went on there with this fella. He is a very strange character. I think it was Padilla that had uncovered some strange stuff about him, and right after that is when Lee went south and took himself out of the media exposure. Before that, he had advertised for a slave, personal slave, 24/7 on call, must have a car, must have a college degree, which he didn't have, which he was asking for, and there would be no pay. So this was a guy of great arrogance, just like his sister, who's very arrogant. And it's really difficult for me to say at this point because for 3 years, Cindy Anthony has done everything she could to protect Casey, every lie possible. And then at the last moment, she told very few lies on stands, and some were lies. But she did basically testify for the prosecution. Lee was much weaker in the prosecution. He didn't hurt us, I agree with that. But I think that he very well may testify on behalf of the defense and maybe blow this thing out there in a real strange direction.
Okay. That's an interesting point, and I'm hearing it now from a couple of you. Dave, it's my understanding that Lee is basically one of the scapegoats. You know, someone that the defense wants to burn at the stake. I mean, can you see him suddenly rolling over and?
Well, you know, here's the thing that I take issue with. You know, number one, the defense set him on fire. I mean, they literally attempted to burn him at the stake in their opening statement. Okay, so in other words, Lee was no hero to the defense. And the defense made it extremely clear that he was no hero. Secondly, you don't see what goes on outside of that courtroom. On the 23rd floor, when Lee interacts with his parents during the breaks. So, you know, anybody can sit there and say whatever they want while he testifies for a half hour and assume everything. But, you know, I don't think it's that simple. I think it's kind of like dumb to just automatically come up with a whatever his design is and say that you can base it on anything. I mean, look at the defense, what they did to him. You know, and he didn't testify to anything that was not beneficial to the state.
Simon.
He's got a sore ass, that's all.
Simon.
Well, yeah, go ahead. It's not that. I mean, it's really, I'm not defending the guy. That's not my point. But I don't see him as a hero for the defense. When the defense is saying that he tried to, do things to his sister. I mean, they accused him of this.
They didn't say it on the stand yet, and I believe, Dave, that he's going to come to his sister's rescue. Otherwise, he made a big grandstand during the ceremony, CMA. I'll never forget the promise I made to you. That means I'm going to throw your mama under the bus when it all comes
sure.
to his.
Sure, but that was before he had the opportunity to come clean with the state when they called him in for a second what do you call it?
Didn't work the district.
The second time in August.
It wouldn't work there. It only can work in front of a jury because it's reasonable doubt. This wouldn't have anything to do with the detectives asking questions. It wouldn't sway them one way or the other. But it will sway the jury.
Well, what did he say in particular that that worked for the benefit of the defense?
He hasn't done it yet. What he's going to do?
Just wanted to clarify that.
By throwing Cindy Anthony under the bus in a big way, and that it's not that he said anything to help anybody at this stage. It wouldn't work at this stage. It will only work when in the presence of the jury, when the jury hears it and hears. All of a sudden, and you'll be shocked. You'll be sitting there, and all of a sudden, you'll be like, oh, shit, he's going to say it. And when he says it, that's it.
Okay, folks, I need to break in. If I don't let the crime doctor speak, he's going to give us all a frontal lobotomy.
Yeah, Simon, before we move off of this particular subject, I wanted to ask a question, see if I'm on the right track here or not. After Cindy testified, and she got a lot of kudos from people, you know, about what a great witness she was and the emotion and so on and so forth, and that was all fine and good. And Baez, especially when you compare his cross of her to that of George, was very gentle. And I realize I've never been a lawyer, but I can appreciate that she was a very sympathetic figure, and it probably might have been a bad strategy to go into the full attack mode against her. But my speculation is that at some point, Cindy is going to be brought into this by the defense as the dysfunctional family, as a domineering person, a control freak, and so on and so forth. And if it's uncomfortable, perhaps it could backfire by one of the attorneys going after Cindy directly. A witness such as Lee, if he's so inclined, might be their way to get her and portray her in a different light than the person we saw on the stand last Friday and Saturday, a week ago Friday and Saturday, and bring her in as this kind of a bad apple here. And I'm just wondering, does anybody share my opinion that we haven't heard the last of Cindy Anthony, that there's going to be some things come out about her that are negative instead of the positive?
You're grandmother. And here's how I know that you're 100% right. If you were listening, what has happened is they brought all these 911 calls in right now. They have to keep her kind of cool. It shows a woman. In fact, the admissions from the judge to the jury after they played, this is not about her thievery or still in the car. This is showing the mindset of Cindy Anthony. That was the admission to the jury after they played everything. So everything has been set into motion to allow that. This is this woman here freaking out. I've got my daughter. I want her arrested, yada, yada. It shows her mindset. In fact, Baez said that, but he said it in a gentle way. Then the judge gave the admonition to the jury in a nice way. And it's all being set and planned perfectly, because if he attacked her right now, the raw emotions, I mean, some people are fooled by the tears and the crocodile tears and everything. She was doing a lot of head shaking. She acted as if she was embarrassed by her behavior of calling 911 and throwing her daughter under the bus and doing all that. So Baez had to take a soft hand approach. Otherwise, that would have put it in the mind of the jury that they're picking on this poor woman. So he kind of like let that flow. The judge let it flow. Everybody let it flow. And then, yes, they're going to use Lee to come in and slam her ass. Watch and see.
Okay, folks, I'm just going to break in for a second. We have a caller on the line, and I think I might even recognize the number. Someone coming in from the 352 area code?
Good afternoon.
I knew you wouldn't be able to stay away. How's it going, TJ?
Quite interesting. I've been following this, although I don't report on these stories anymore, I've been following a great deal of interest, kind of on the outside, looking in, not necessarily from the court proceedings, but how people have been reacting to it, and it's been unusual.
Okay, for the benefit of our listeners, the caller is none other than the infamous T.J. Hart. He is the programming director for the Sky 97 out of Gainesville, Florida, good friend of the program. T.J., it is wonderful to talk to you again.
Thank you. I've missed my family here.
I got to talk to you, TJ, if you miss this group.
I miss you, TJ.
I didn't say, did I forget the word dysfunctional before family?
Yeah, I think you did.
That's what makes us a family, man.
That's true, makes it real. I was down in Orlando.
From a radio perspective, Gainesville, you run what, a 50,000 watt station?
Correct, and it goes all the way down to just the edge of Orlando, as a matter of fact. And
right,
so we got a lot of folks between here and there.
What sort of feedback are you getting from your listeners? Are they interested in this case?
Oh yeah, it's more slanted toward women. We're monitoring things that happen on our internet, and also the feedback that we get from each and every story. You know, when we have proprietary means of telling what works and what doesn't, and I'll tell you right now that online feed of the courtroom proceedings about breaks the server every time court's in session, and that is the most read page on our website, and of course it's a pretty safe bet that it's going to be one of the top three stories in our newscast, each and every day trial is in session. And that's because people do want to know. We're finding out that there are a lot of ladies who are watching the proceedings on their computer, or at least they're listening to it with the picture minimized on whatever source that they're using. Many, many different folks, including bloggernews.net, are carrying it. So, a lot of folks are tuning in. The men have a tendency, they want to get a bite-sized information, a little bit of a scenario of what's going on, but they're not really deeply entrenched into it. I will tell you that I was in Orlando last weekend, and it was, I think it was Thursday or Friday. It was nuts. There were people outside the courthouse, and I went down there. I didn't have anything to do with the convention I was at until about noon that day. But early in the morning, before the sun was even up, there were people lined up trying to get into the Orange County courthouse to get a seat in the trial for the Anthony case. It was crazy. It looked like those wedding dress sales in New York, somebody's closet or somebody's basement or whatever it's called. The ladies were, right since they opened the doors, wham! You thought the Beatles were in town, and it was 1964. And I thought that was just absolutely crazy. But the media coverage down here in Florida is unbelievable. You have a couple of TV stations in the Orlando market are carrying wall-to-wall coverage of this, as well as True TV and others. And a couple of radio stations are carrying the trial proceedings on the air down in the Orlando area as well. And it's fascinated a lot of people. Of course, they've had a three-year buildup. They just want to see this thing come to an end and some justice be served.
Do you think it's possible for the young lady to get a fair trial with the amount of media coverage that the case is getting?
Well, that varies case for case. In this case, I think so. In some cases where you're going, well, maybe this guy didn't do it, and you worry about it an awful lot. In this case, I just don't see any way that she can prevail in this case or get out of it. I listened to you, to Cobra talk, well, he's going to do this on the defense, he's going to do that. And again, we get back to the same basic issue. They can't explain it. And let me raise this question, because I have a question for Jan. I mean, we all enjoy TV shows like Without a Trace and Criminal Minds. And the first thing you hear in those stories is those first few hours are essential. That first day is the biggest thing in the world. After 3 days, it's hard to find a missing person. So every juror, anyone who watches these nationally syndicated shows and CSI, et cetera, know how important this is. If they didn't know it, for all practical purposes. So we're back to how do they explain this missing thing? So every member of the jury is saying to himself, how could she go this time without reporting? How could all these things happen without a reason? And I'm going to speak to everybody as a father. I raised two children. And even when I was married and I was starving through college with a child, my wife would be at classes and I watched that kid like a hawk. If you blinked, you worried about him. If you walked to the kitchen in the back, you worried about him. Once I left my daughter to answer her phone and to drag the phone back, and by the time I got back, she'd got her hand into a bottle of Vaseline and was putting Vaseline all over her. So all parents are paranoid. A child, you don't let them out of your sight for a couple minutes. Even when they're 6, 7, 8 year olds, mothers worry about them going to the market. Watch out for guys. We know the litany. As a teenager, I wish my children would disappear for 30 days. I would have probably paid them to disappear. But if they were an hour late for dinner, like every parent, I'd be searching for them. I'd be ready to call the police. I'd be calling everywhere. Where did this happen? Now, I'm asking Jan, as a mother, speak for the mothers who listen to the show. Speak for the mothers of America. What was your view if your child is missing 2 minutes when they're young, 10 minutes when they're in the middle age, or a couple hours as a teenager? Tell us, Jan.
Manny, the only thing I can tell you is the first thing I'd have done was yell for help. I mean, I would have screamed to the top of my lungs. And I believe I told this last year or somewhere on one of the shows that we did. My son was 16 years old, and we were on a public bus in Calgary in Canada. And he got off the back door, out through the back door, and I got off through the front door. And I didn't see him. I couldn't find him. He disappeared. I was literally banging on the side of the bus, screaming, "Where's my son? Where's my son?" And I was looking for a cop because they always have cops walking around in that area. And I was looking for him, and when I did, for the cop, I mean, and when I did, I looked up, and there was my son looking up because he had walked up the steps already from where we had got off. It wasn't a bus. It was we was getting off to get onto the train. And I remember freaking out, and he was old enough to literally take care of himself if he had to, but I freaked out because my kid was gone and I couldn't find him. So I can't imagine her, even if it happened like the way Baez said it happened, I can't imagine her letting her daddy take the baby if it did happen like that without wanting to call 911 and getting somebody to help her. If they drug her out of the pool, I mean, that is a possibility that could have happened, but I just can't imagine any mother not wanting to try to give CPR or calling for 911 to help to try to revive the child. I just can't believe, well, I'm so scared of my mother, we're just going to have to hide that my child's dead. I'll never believe that as long as I live. Sorry.
It's her.
Okay.
And that's my point in response to your friend whose name I suddenly lost in the media, is that also accounts for the huge female interest in the outcome of this case,
mm-hmm.
because it strikes to the core of motherhood and failing of motherhood. And it's also why I say to you at times, this is an indictment of this younger generation. I have friends, former clients who moved to Europe. Some of them were famous actors who were British and who were clients when I was practicing. And when I talk to them, we talk frequently. The first thing they ask me is, you know, I've been watching a little bit of the Casey Anthony trial, and what's wrong with American parents? I mean, they see this as an indictment of all American parents. And, I just shake my head. And so others who stand away from this see this as an indictment of parenthood in general and the way it's being conducted in the United States at this time.
Okay, TJ, I'm going to bring you back in. We were joking online a little bit earlier today about being old. You know, you have what, 5 grandchildren, is it?
Yes, 5.
Yeah. I mean, could you imagine, you know, the grief of one missing for a couple of minutes when they were young, You know,
I couldn't imagine that for a second. Shopping with the three oldest ones, they're all within, you know, a couple of years of each other. I just remember as a young father that if one wandered off, if we were at a mall or at a grocery store, it was like, hey, everybody stop. That's fine. We don't leave eyesight of each other. And, you know, it was just, yeah, you get crazy about that. You really do. With the grandkids, I get that way too. I can't fathom anybody having a child missing for more than a minute or two without having panic. It just isn't right. I mean, that's your natural instinct as a parent, both as a father and a mother. But mothers are more so than fathers. They're quicker to react. I'm not saying that fathers are the quickest. They like to say, all right, you know, calm down a little bit, and then they panic.
Right.
That is true, though. I mean, the father wants to reason with things, get the facts out, but a mother doesn't want to wait for that. All she wants is help. Somebody help me with my child.
Okay, I have to ask Peter this question. Peter, I know that you have young children. What would you do if one disappeared?
Well, Stephen King said that no horror book he's ever written or movie he's ever seen or anything he could ever conjure up can come as close to the horror that parents can experience just worrying over their children. So I'm more focused right now on how it is that Cindy Anthony, for instance, went to see her daughter in jail and the child was missing, but yet there's giggling going on and talking about weight and all that sort of stuff, and George as well. So I don't think that this is any type of barometer to set a standard of norm to go on. The bar in this case is set really, really in a bizarre place where we can't even find it. This is the most dysfunctional family I've probably ever seen.
but that's my point, is that no matter what you do with this case, you come back to that fundamental question. How do you explain the lack of emotional response or any response whatsoever to this child being missing for this protracted period of time and not look at the parents and assess blame? So based upon that thought... go ahead. I was going to say that's the hardest thing for me to get over.
Yeah, the part that I see that very clearly is that Kaylee was a novelty. She was a... there's one thing to have affections towards a child, and I have six children, and I taught parenting for 16 years, and I've done worked on child abuse for almost a decade. There's affections, and there's love, and there's a difference. And love is defined as seeking the highest good of its object, doing that which is right. So I don't doubt their affections for the child. I don't doubt any of those things, but they lived in denial, which is a type of self-deception. I know it because I live there sometimes myself. I see a bill on the table. I don't open it. I don't want to see it right now. Like Scarlett O'Hara, I'll look at it tomorrow. I'll think about it tomorrow. They lived that way with their daughter. But you have to remember that while she was living there for 2 years, they knew that she wasn't working. They knew there was no nanny. They knew all this was nonsense, and they did not question her. Which one of us as men, just the men here, could say that if our daughter, a 19-year-old daughter, was pregnant, that we wouldn't demand right then and there to know who the father was? Yet these people did not pursue that. They're afraid of her. She bullies them in the jailhouse tapes. And so everything goes back to the fact that Kaylee was a novelty. She was her name is a novelty, the conjuring up of Casey and Lee Anthony's both names together. The fact that we the public, question whether or not George or Lee could be the father tells us how strange that we perceive them to be. So I think that they are capable of a lot more than we would realize. And I'm even open to the fact that, I know this is really off, Simon, but people have wondered, was Casey planning on killing her parents to get the house?
I heard that too. I even thought of that myself.
Okay, that's a new one on me, but
Well, she was planning. She was telling their friend that her parents was moving away, and that she was going to have the house. They were making plans. Even went out shopping for furniture or something like that. So she was definitely saying all that. So maybe she did.
No, was she searching for chloroform for the parents?
Right.
Was she searching for the chloroform? And it's
well,
when I first heard that, I scratched my head too, and then I stopped and I started thinking, why would I dismiss this so quickly when she was capable of taking the life of a little cutie who wasn't even 3 years old?
What, can I interject
you know,
here?
Dave,
I
was just about to head to you. Go ahead.
Well, the fact remains that when the state attempted to go to this, killing the parents story, the judge nipped in the bud and said, look, we're not going to go there. So if we're not going to go there in the trial, what's the point of studying this further? I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. You know, to me, the point and the only thing that's important now is what's going on in the trial, not things that may have happened in, you know, had Casey never been caught.
Well, wait a minute, though. This isn't about...
Yeah, I don't want to be that close-minded.
Yeah, this isn't about
the
truth of the matter.
No, it's not being
close-minded. Wait a minute. It's not about the truth of the matter. It's about the fact that your opinion of her has deteriorated to the point where someone would consider it. So it is not about whether or not it happened. What it is like a Rorschach drawing of destroyed confidence and suspicion. And
well,
that
then
alone.
Why didn't the judge judge allow it to go there then?
Well, because
there's
a rule called 352 that says when the prejudicial effect of evidence far exceeds its evidentiary value, then it is too dangerous to admit. And in this case, I could easily see why a judge would not admit it without some classic tie to where the case is, and it shouldn't be admitted. I think it's spacious, but the fact remains that anyone who considered that would, in fact, be prejudiced towards voting guilty whether they weren't going to vote anyway. And I agree with you. To me, it's almost an admission against interest. And an admission against interest is a form of a confession. That's where you admit to something that is against your personal interest that in many ways conveys the appearance of being guilty. And, yes, I do think that is that. And I agree with you. It really has no evidentiary value other than to help establish the fact that everybody's confidence or belief in her is so undermined that they would believe that.
Well, I still think that, I mean, too many times people write too much into this case. You know, oh, she would have done this, she could have done that. But the fact remains that if it's not accepted in the court, then it's just nothing more than second-guessing. That's all. You know, I'm not condemning anyone thinking that.
Right,
but the thing
you know
is, why don't
do
we just...
On the radio program, though,
is
outside the scope of the trial?
No, but now that it is part of everything that is part of the trial, there's so much to talk about the trial.
I agree.
Okay, I want to bring in Denny. He's not like the rest of us. He doesn't barge in, but I'm sure he's just sat there chomping at the bit. Denny, your thoughts?
Yeah, I want to back up a little bit, if I could, to something that did happen in the courtroom, and back up to the testimony of Cindy Anthony. And Peter said a little earlier in the show that he thought overall she was a good witness and told the truth, but she may have lied, I think he said a little bit or a couple of times. One of the things that I thought may have been a disappointment to the prosecution in her testimony was the issue of the smell in the car. And she said that, clearly it was on the 911 call, there's smell like there'd been a dead body in the damn car. But when she testified, she said that, well, she just meant that more or less as a figure of speech. It really, you know, actually she thought it was garbage or trash. And I'm wondering, first of all, is that one of the, what Peter considered to be a possible lie? Was that one of the things? Or was she, and what's everybody else think? Was she trying to backpedal on that to do what she could for Casey? Or was she sincere? Was it just a figure of speech and it really, the smell wasn't quite that bad? So maybe Peter could answer first. Did he detect that was an area she was truthful in?
If I could, I think the area that stood out the most was
what you just said, Denny, the smell in the car, that she recognized the smell, and I had personally smelled it, decomposition, decades ago, and it's something that no training is needed, and once smelled, it's never mistaken for anything else. It initiates the gag reflex. It's horrific.
Yeah,
and she went from there to garbage, to rotting pizza, to everything else. And so when she actually backpedaled twice on that. She first backpedaled where she didn't want to admit that that was decomposition because that makes her look like a liar from all the other media things that she said it didn't smell. And then later on she said it was worse than what she had smelled at a morgue or wherever it was when they were doing the nursing training. So if you take that she smelled human decomposition way back in 08 when they got the car, that would make sense of why that she was playing for the cameras when she was doing the jailhouse speaking with Casey, saying, now, tell me about Zenaida. And then Casey would say, no, I don't want to talk about it now. And then she'd say, oh, okay, honey, it's okay, we don't talk about it. And then they would laugh and giggle about other things like that. She didn't believe for a minute that Kaylee was alive and missing anywhere. She knew from the very beginning when she smelled her granddaughter. And it's sad and it's pathetic and it's difficult, but it's not truthful. And I think it's a major point here. So when she first testified, I didn't know whether she was going to testify and throw George under and say George molested or that she would protect George and Lee. But they didn't hammer Lee. They just said that he was following in his father's footsteps, but he didn't go any further into any gross details. So I can't predict which way Cindy's going to go. I don't know if she's going to be truthful or if she's going to throw Lee and George under the bus and try to protect Casey. I don't know.
TJ, who is going to get thrown under this very busy bus? Do you think Cindy and George and Lee are destined for that?
George and Lee, you heard the thump on the very first day. They got thrown under the bus by the defense. But I think when the families start coming a little bit more out of it, I think you're probably going to see Lee get thrown under the bus as he attempts to throw Casey under the bus. And I think they probably had enough of George at this point in time. I think Cindy's quite vulnerable.
All right. I want to change gears just a little bit. I want to talk about Amy Huizinga and the and those damn checks. Manny, you're a man with decades of courtroom experience. When was the last time you saw a witness called to a sidebar?
I've never seen a witness called to a sidebar except to warn them, and usually what they do is dismiss the jury, that if they keep doing what they're doing, the judge is going to sanction them in some way for some type of conduct that they deem inappropriate. Namely, the judge, a lot of times it's lawyers or other professionals who are evading questions, and the judge doesn't want to embarrass them, and they pull them off the side and go, look, cut out the nonsense or I'm going to start sanctioning you. I had a case where a judge was so upset with an expert accountant who once put in a position did not really want to testify to something, so he kept basically avoiding the question. So the judge said, look, I'm not going to embarrass you, but every time you do that, I'm going to fine you $500. So I, along with opposing counsel and others, the court reporter, et cetera, started to keep track of it. And then, of course, at the break, we all got a little pool together to see who would come closest, the number of times he would equivocate, try to sidestep or whatever. And it turned out he got fined about $8,000. So that's one of the only situation I've ever seen where a judge pulled somebody aside or cleared a jury to talk to a witness privately.
Dave, you were in the courtroom, I think. Were you as aghast as everyone else was?
Well, the only thing I remember really about Amy was, the first thing I noticed was, and we all kind of noticed, was, boy, she lost a lot of weight since the days that she was in the news over this whole mess. But, you know, she really, that's aside from that, because that's not really important, she did really well on the stand. I mean, when Baez tried to impeach her, he called her a drunk. She came right out and said, "I'm not on trial here." And of course, he said something else about her. Maybe it was about her accident. He said something else about her, and I have it in my notes. But she came out of it smelling like a rose. I mean, she really impressed me. She was very smart.
Peter, how do you think Amy fared?
I agree with Dave. I think she did really well. One part that really touched me was, actually, my wife Heather pointed it out. Amy had apparently been working two jobs, and the type of work she was doing, she said that she was always looking for work, but she was looking while she was working. And Heather pointed out that Amy was working two jobs, and Casey wasn't working at all, and Casey stole from Amy. And it just kind of heightened that understanding of stealing from someone that's working hard. It's rough.
Oh, that's what it was. It was the second one was about stealing her boyfriend's, as Snoopy just said. But that was nothing. I mean, she said she wasn't dating that guy, Grund, I guess.
Right. Okay.
Let me change about the event, Simon. Let me ask everybody their feelings about the tapes and what was played from them. And I've heard people say, well, they were posturing this or that. There were times, even with the father, I listened to the entire tape of the father, and I couldn't tell between when he was trying to get her to talk about what she knew or where the Kaylee could be or any of that other stuff, and when he was posturing for what I believe were the cameras, so to speak. But he seemed to mix the two together, and if someone posted, they thought it shut down her defense, and I really did too. I mean, I think it's really hard for her to argue any defense at all that incorporates her father based upon that tape. I don't think he behaved like someone who had any indication of what was going on.
Boy, you hit that one right on the money.
I think you have hit on a very important aspect, and I think that was why Baez was fighting tooth and nail to not allow those tapes to be played. I mean, Peter, they were damaging to the defense.
Yeah, it was incredible. And watching Cindy fall apart as she is confronted with reality, I think Bill Schaefer was the one that said that he had never seen such drama and doubted he ever would see that much drama again in a trial. It was incredible. All the information. And I think one of the most important parts of that was that here it was, she's giving descriptions of the alleged kidnapper, of the nanny, and she's giving details on the hair straightener, and don't you remember, Mom, that's what I borrowed it from, of course. And Casey and Cindy had to realize each one of these things, how persuasive Casey was attempting to be over and over and over, and I really felt sorry for Cindy Anthony at that moment. I really did. I think it was rough listening to that stuff.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, I have listened to those tapes, albeit quite a long time ago. It was illuminating to listen to them back to back once again. The one thing that came across crystal clear, at least to me, was if George Anthony was this evil child molester, and someone was playing a really, really strange poker hand, didn't you get that impression?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I look back at one of the things that that Baez made clear in the opening statement was that George found the body in the pool. So, all right, let's just pick on that for a second. There's that, not River Cruz, but the sister, whatever, whoever the sister was of those two, you know, not tens that George was purportedly dating. And she's going to testify for the defense that George told her that it was an accident, Kaylee drowned. Okay, well, that's great. But you know what's really interesting, and that's something we could talk about, but interestingly, you know, during this whole thing, these videos, some people may have thought they were boring, but the jury didn't. The jury was glued to those videos. And one of the things that was noticed was that when Kaylee said, or when Casey said, all I care about is Kaylee, or whatever she said about caring about Kaylee, one juror just rolled her eyes. So that's kind of interesting that you see that kind of reaction. As much as they're just trying to be as unresponsive as possible, they are paying attention to everything that goes on in that courtroom.
But that's my point. The first time anyone sees her care is when she's in jail. That's a little late to start caring about your child, and that's the issue that's, I believe, haunting the jury. If she cared so much about her child, this is not the actions that a normal parent would
have
taken.
Right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just want to say,
well, on top of that, the defense came right out and said she died June 16th. That was the opening bell. So when she was finally arrested the following day, everything that came out from that point on, Casey had since admitted she knew the girl was dead. And she taunted her parents. She taunted her family. And she laughed at everyone.
I agree. Now, my point was a little bit different about this. My point is that, you know, there's expectations. And in negligence is defined as conduct that falls below a substantial conduct. And the same is true with sanity. It's whether the conduct of the individual falls below the standard of society. So there's an inherent measuring of her by the standards in society, which we discussed earlier between Jan and I. And she does not pass that test.
No.
That's simple. And that's, so every time she makes this kind of comment, the jurors are going to roll their eyes because it isn't consistent with the conduct of a mother. And that's where this case completely falls apart for them, is because they have no apparent ability to demonstrate to anybody how her conduct conforms with that of any normal mother in the United States. And that's a big problem.
Big problem.
I'm going to throw another curveball into the game here. In the opening statements, Mr. Byers told us that she'd been abused by George, and Lee had attempted to abuse her, but might not be successful, or might not have been successful. Also, that a major player was meter reader Roy Kronk. Peter, how on earth are the defense going to put this together into any kind of cohesive presentation to the jury?
Well, why'd you put it on me to try to make a cohesive answer out of Jose Baez? That's not fair.
Okay, unfair question.
Well, if you started off by saying that it was an accidental drowning in the pool, it may have had legs, but then he had to add in George and the molestation. Okay, that's taking it kind of far. And then he had to add Roy Kronk in. And at that point, it was one of those Casey type of lies where she adds in so many details that it becomes obvious to anybody and everybody. So when he took it further beyond just the drowning, I think he really shot himself in the foot. Of course, they're going to ask, well, why after 3 years did you suddenly report an accident? But that'll be for greater minds than mine. So to answer your question, I can't. I can't make sense of the defense and how they're going to tie Roy Kronk in.
Right. To me, he gave too much information. You know, if he just said it's simple, she'd drown in the family pool. You know, she was Casey was afraid of her father. The body was disposed of. Life would have been good. But no, you know, he's got this elaborate game, and boy, it's going to be hard to sell. Would you agree with that, Manny?
Well, I don't think what he does is going to be easy to sell. You guys assume that there's some kind of defense here, and I come back to the point that, you know, you basically have a child who's been missing for this protracted period of time without any explanation other than the likelihood that she was murdered by a family member. So to now for her to admit that, oh, well, she died, or, you know, fine, that means that you've been lying all this time. So all she did is further underscore the fact that she's a pathological liar. How does that help her case? I have trouble understanding that one, too. So, but the point is that any defense that he tries to assert at this point is not going to work because she doesn't have a defense. She either has an explanation for the 30 days missing or this period of time missing, and the lack of explanation, the fact that she didn't report it, or she doesn't. And so far, she doesn't. And if she thinks that arguing being sexually abused is going to help, my first response to this is, so what? I know that's a terrible thing to say because I've dealt with a lot of sexual abuse among clients, too. It's a terrible thing. And I can tell you from my experiences with them, they don't react the way these people have reacted in this case. And I think that anyone who has dealt with any kind of abuse in a family will tell you these are not actions. This is not how families deal with it. This isn't normal. So does anybody disagree with that?
Oh, no, not at all.
No way. What they're trying to do is make it as if any bizarre behavior, any guilty behavior, anything left or right, well, that's indicative of sexual abuse. That's how broad of a brush he's painting. But Manny's dead on there. I've had more experience with families in sexual abuse than I ever would want to have experience with, and that's not how they respond. So he's right. They have nothing they can do with these 31 days, Simon. Nothing.
It's a cop-out.
Denny, do you think that Baez overplayed his hand in the opening statements?
Yeah, I think I agree with everybody else when he brought in the, you know, just Casey and Kaylee were home alone. Casey was reading a book, and Kaylee somehow got in the pool and drowned. Well, yeah, you could tell that, but when he brought George in and George carrying Kaylee's wet body back around the house and, you know, and then they engage in this big cover-up and then crank and all this, I thought he did, but I wanted to make two points. I thought last week there were two of the recordings that were played that I thought were the most devastating to the defense. One was, I believe it was the audio only of the three detectives interviewing Casey at Universal Studios. Because now you got Casey in her own words, lie after lie after lie, and the police on several occasions, 3, 4, 5, threw her the lifeline. You know, well, I've dealt with women who rolled over on their kids and suffocated them. Their kids drowned in the swimming pool and all that. You need to get this off your chest. You need to get it out there. It can be handled. And she maintained the Zanny the Nanny kidnapping. She refused to grab the rope. The other one, I think, of the defense that goes to Baez and adding George into the mix for the accidental drowning. When I watched the tape, I think they played it Friday morning, it was when George visited Casey alone.
Right.
And they talked for almost an hour, I think it was. And now you got to remember, too, if according to the Baez theory that George was in on this from June 16th on, they would have had to have had their strategy for the jailhouse interview planned ahead of time. Because once July 15th rolled around, they didn't have time to really put their heads together and say, look, Casey, you're probably going to the slammer, so here's what we're going to do. This would have had to have been done back in June, probably. George would had to have put on the act and acting performance of a lifetime to sit there for almost an hour going through item after item about what they were doing to find Kaylee. All these different efforts that were underway, and Casey's responding to him, "Oh, Dad, that's great, and, you know, what would we do without you out there trying to get her back? And we're going to get her back. I can feel it. And George, yeah, we're all going to be a big, happy family again when this is over with." So all this is going on, and for me, I was skeptical, of course, when Baez threw that out there on opening. But after watching and hearing that tape of the two of them, even though they knew it was recorded, I can't believe that they could go through that whole dialogue for almost an hour with neither one of them letting the cat out of the bag somehow, that they had a secret, that they were both in on this. And so that took it totally off the table for me.
It was hugely damaging.
And an analyst, Simon, and it might have been the Schaefer guy that Peter mentioned a short time ago, I believe it was right after that tape was played, the one I just talked about of George and Casey, said that he had to believe that Baez did not actually screen these tapes before he came out with that defense. Because if he knew that tape was there, it would have been almost suicidal, strategy-wise, to come up with throwing George into the mix. And another comment was made, maybe Manny would want to address this, that the analyst, and I think it was Schaefer, said he could see no way that Chaney Mason knew what was in those recordings, or he would have put his foot down and not allowed Baez to go with the accidental thing with George in it as part of the conspiracy. I don't know what anybody else thought about that as far as the defense team goes. But this one analyst said that he saw no way Chaney Mason could have been aware that that tape existed. If he was, he would not have allowed that to be part of the opening statement.
Oh, okay. These tapes got a good deal of airtime, excuse the pun, you know, with defense objecting violently to their inclusion. And Judge Perry was fair and firm. He said, look, you've had them, you know, since the dawn of time. Why are you objecting now? Dave, do you think that they should have objected during the discovery phase?
You know what? The defense tried to have those tapes snuffed out of, evidence. They didn't want them to be shown. And the judge rightfully decided that he doesn't have any control over matters that are not judicial side of the law. So he didn't have much of a chance. The jail and discovery laws in the state of Florida is what made those tapes available. I don't think that the defense could have had pieces and parts, you know, chopped out of it. The whole thing would come in the way it was because it's part of discovery. But there's one thing that really surprises me that no one really picked up on. When the defense in the opening statement said something about George being involved in this, then it turned right around later during one, and asked about why did Casey make all those phone calls to her mother the afternoon of the 16th, you know, as if to imply that she was looking for some kind of family help or something. But if George was involved in the death of that child earlier in the day, why would the defense be asking about anything that transpired later in the afternoon? That's one of the things that really puzzles me.
Peter, any comments on that aspect?
No, I think that it does play it to my amusement when Baez asks for a sidebar and we hear, no.
So Mr. Baez,
he's moving us along.
Mr. Bias, no.
Okay, Manny, do you think that the defense had any opportunity to have portions of those tapes redacted?
I don't know how he could. I mean, they speak for themselves. If you're dumb enough to sit in a prison cell or a county jail mm-hmm. and do what she did, you get what you deserve, and that's pretty
absolutely.
And I think that's generally the feeling of everybody in the legal business. You know, if you don't want this stuff repeated, keep your mouth shut. It's that simple. So the judge sort of felt to himself and probably giggled to himself, saying, you know, back to our discussion of being felony stupid. I mean, her father's an ex-cop, right? So he certainly knew what was going on with this, and he certainly knew the Florida law, and he certainly knew the likelihood that all of this could happen. So, you know, he went in there, you know, with his eyes wide open. But I also think he went in there hoping to, by asking these questions, he was going to make her look better. I'm not sure he didn't walk out there horrified by her responses, because the responses were basically horrible for her. So he was hoping he would give her a chance to shine a little bit, and all she did was underscore the failings of her case.
And okay, I want you to clarify something. I happen to know the answer to the question. Manny and I were talking on the phone, I think it was yesterday, and he came up with this delightful phrase, felony stupid. Would you like to explain that?
Well, felony stupid is a description that a lot of my friends and the prosecutors use about people who commit crimes but really have no education at all and don't realize they're committing crimes. And I think the example I used was of a particular case where I was involved with one of the parties, and it was a blue-collar crime, and the client said, blah, 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 and I could hear the policeman lean over to, actually it was a sergeant, lean over to the prosecutor and said, gee, that's fine, that's a crime too. So the guy, in talking himself out of one crime, admitted to another version of the same crime because he just didn't know what the law was and what the difference was, and prosecutors call this being felony stupid, and it is. And it's back to our ongoing mantra, Simon, that we don't teach crime and other things or any criminal law to children in school, so they basically will make these mistakes constantly because they just don't know they're committing a crime sometimes. And I'm talking about things like U-turns, simpler things. I mean, the ones that relate to the Bible, the moral issues are completely different. In fact, for our audience very quickly, there are two types of laws, malum in se and malum in prohibitum. Malum in se is exactly what it means, bad in itself, and those are crimes that you generally find listed in the Bible and the Ten Commandments. Malum in prohibitum are those ones the government creates, which are exceeding 55 miles an hour on a highway in the middle of Florida, which is probably up to 70, or, you know, some other minor thing. A parking violation is a classic malum prohibitum. You may have committed a crime, but you certainly haven't done anything morally wrong. So those are the distinctions between it. But that is a major problem with today's youth, is they don't have a clue when they're violating the law unless it's something clearly morally or ethically wrong, and they realize, oops, I remember somewhere in Sunday school I shouldn't be doing this. Does that give you enough of an explanation?
It does indeed. Okay, later on last week, we got into the long march, those damn yellow envelopes. I know that it has to happen, but boy, it was boring, boring, boring. And it represented the start of the next phase, the science. I'm a believer that juries and science just don't work well together. It's very much an oil and water situation, and I use the O.J. Simpson trial as a great example. I mean, DNA I'm interested in what the panel thinks about how the jury is going to react to the science. Dave, do you want to kick it off?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, for one thing, it was a boring time. There's no doubt about that. One of the things that we have to follow is a simple rule that if anyone's caught sleeping, it's an immediate ejection from the courtroom. And probably you won't be able, you'll get your ticket taken away from you for those that come in from the public, and you'll never be able to come back in.
Does that include the judge?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, you know, it was boring, but also I've been told by some pretty important people down there that each one of the prosecutors and defense attorneys have their own personality, which we all know. But, you know, one thing about the prosecution is that Ashton is a little bit hot-headed. I think we've all witnessed that. Frank George is a guy that you want to go out and have a beer with. But Linda Drane Burdick is probably the most boring one with her presentations, which, you know, she's kind of monotone or whatever. She's not very much excitable. But it, you know, I don't know, would it have been any different if somebody else would have relayed it? I don't know.
No.
I mean, not really, but I mean, it's a necessary evil. And I think that as the trial progresses, you're going to see those little bits of evidence. Right now, she's just entering them into evidence. You know.
No. My question is, how do you think the jury is going to handle the science?
Simon,
Let me ask that.
There's science the juries are interested in. There's science that they aren't. In this case, I have one that I'm interested in because I meant to ask you a number of times about it. There's, this defense that she drowned, okay? What I don't understand, because I have not seen the technical evidence, is from what I understand, the cause of death was strangulation. If she had drowned, that is one area that is almost universally agreed to. So if they're alleging she drowned, how the hell are they going to prove it if the evidence is the contrary? And when that evidence comes up, I guarantee you the jury's eyes will be just glued to it. There'll be areas of evidence that I don't think will have any significant effect, like this hair discussion is so small on a level of importance that it won't have a major effect, and they'll tend to doze during those. But if I, you know, and I was uncertain about it, Simon, so I asked my wife, who's was a registered nurse in three different states throughout her career and really understands this technical stuff, as Simon will tell you, very, very well. And she just scoffed and laughed and said, look, one of the easiest causes of death to determine is drowning. And either she drowned or she didn't.
We only have a bag of bones.
There wasn't enough flesh or anything to determine any of those issues?
No, zero.
Oh, boy, then that's even a bigger problem for them.
Right.
To let a child's life deteriorate to the point where it's all that's discovered is a bag of bones, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's sad. I still maintain that science and juries don't mix, but you know, this is, you know, personal opinion. I was talking to a criminal defense lawyer earlier this week, and you know, I said it to him, and he said, "Oh no, you're completely wrong. You know, we live in the CSI world. Yeah, you gotta have the science." But jury expects it. I don't know. I don't see it. You know, Saturday morning was a yawner, and it was one of the few occasions where Jose Paez actually scored a bit of a, well, I won't say home run, but he definitely got on base. Well, all of these photographs of this hair business, how come there isn't one single photograph of the actual hair? And
oh, you know what? I saw one. I saw
you
the
did.
Skull in the I saw the skull in the opening statement from the prosecution. They showed a side. First, they showed the picture of the last known photograph taken of Kaylee alive. That's when she was up at that old folks' home. And then they presented a second photo of Kaylee, and it was put side by side with the last known one of her alive, and here she was dead. And it was in the woods. Her skull was sticking out of leaves and dirt. And her hair, there were strands of matted hair in different places. Mostly it was a skull, but there were strands, I mean, like kind of like mangy strands of hair.
Well, that certainly adds to it.
Dave, I'm talking about Saturday. And the hair they were talking about was the one
those
found
hairs.
In
yeah, well,
the
that
trunk.
Was something that I'll tell you. Yeah, well, you know, the hairs that I saw were something that I'll never forget. But those hairs, I think the defense did a good job trying to prove that is not, you know, it's not. I think Baez did a good job on the defense by forcing the witnesses to at least admit that they couldn't say it was absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt Kaylee's hair that had the death band. That's one example of it.
Well, the real key, though, was the fact that we've heard your presentation. How come there isn't one single photograph of the hair that you're talking about?
Well, the state did present, you know, that board with that it showed the jury that had five different samples of hair in different stages. So it wasn't really clear that it was one of them was actual hair. I don't know.
No, specifically he asked the question, and it was answered. No, we do not have a photograph. And they got into this discussion about how difficult it is to get cameras and, you know, the stereo microscope, blah, 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 but not one single photograph. A blurry Polaroid would have fixed it.
Well, I didn't really know that they had no photograph of that death band.
I'm not saying they don't have a photograph. I'm saying that, you know, the expert did not produce it.
Well, I wonder, though, if it's in some of those brown envelopes that were admitted into evidence. You know, that the hair itself didn't belong to her any longer. She couldn't submit it. It went back to Orange County with the results of the test. So she said that she didn't take pictures of stuff like the heart on the sticker when they destroyed it and tested. There were no photographs taken of that. And had the state or the police not taken photographs of it, there would be no proof that there was ever a sticker on any duct tape.
Okay, Peter, you're a smart guy. What's your view? Did the prosecution screw up by not having a photograph to show the jury?
Well, I'm with you on the idea of science and the jury. I think that in spite of the TV programs and I think that people get lost pretty quickly, and I think it was a big yawn on Saturday, and I think they need to keep it simple. I don't think Baez hit a home run, but maybe he got on base with a walk on Saturday. But I'm with you. I think they just need to keep it simple and not overdo the science too much.
I have a theory, and I'm going to go around the table with it. My theory is the prosecution needs to get in and out quick on the science.
Yes.
The defense needs to sit there and confuse everyone as much as they can. Manny, would you agree with that comment?
Well, in light of what you just said to me, I don't think the science really factors very much in this case. Basically, the issues are the ones we've discussed, and since you're saying it's a bag of bones, there's not that much to work with, I just don't think it's going to matter what they say, and the less time they devote to science, the more the time they devote to the rest of the case, the better off. I really do.
That's a good point.
You know, that's not the strength of their case. If it's not the strength of your case, don't belabor it.
That's right. That's a good point.
What about you, Denny? Do you agree?
I agree, in and out.
Yep. Dump the science, kill the people.
Let me just tell you what I'm not looking forward to, and I fear it might come, is when Baez puts on his defense, is that we're going to get into a battle of the experts, which I hate, on PTSD or whatever, sexual abuse survivor syndrome, whatever you want to call it. And I hate that when you can take people with virtually the same education and experience and training, give them a set of facts, and they can have totally different interpretations. And a lot of times, you know, what do they call them? I guess the hired gun thing, and I fear we might get into that as part of Baez trying to explain away his client's actions and conduct for that 31-day period. So I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I'm not looking forward to that if it does.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. It just seems to me that the defense strategy just has to be to tie up this phase of the trial as long as they possibly can.
Well, yeah, they can do this as long as the judge doesn't get tired of them. But everybody needs to remember at some point this judge is going to look at this case and come to a conclusion himself. And at that time, he'll start altering his rulings, he'll start doing a lot of different things that will tend to slant the case on the side that he believes we should win the case. And it's just human nature. And it's going to go on in this case, too. So at some point, expect the judge to get filled with this sexual abuse issue and say to himself, we're not getting anywhere. We're wasting time. I'm not going to let him sit here and run forever with this. And then they'll start cutting him off of the knees. And my feeling about those moments is they can never happen soon enough. Because basically, his defense is to throw enough shit against the wall and try and make some of it stick. And at some point, the judge is going to go, okay, enough. You've thrown enough against the wall. It isn't working. So guess what? We're going to move on and your case is done. And that's what's going to happen here.
Yeah. Let me ask you something about that. I got a really good question for you then, Manny. Do you think the judge, I mean, where did the judge cross the line in his own, mind where he has to allow so much because it's a death case, the rules are different, and where he says, okay, enough is enough? Is there, like, a particular line anywhere?
Well, first of all, each judge has his particular line and level of patience. Some are infamous, and you generally know who they are when you're practicing law, and where their line is, and you know exactly when you're done. And these two lawyers may well understand what that line is from the judge based upon private conversations, because generally the judge gives them to them. So when it comes to certain issues, or even the tapes, and even the handling of some of the witnesses, the judge may have well have said to Baez, I don't want you attacking her at this phase of the case. If you do so, you do so at your own risk. If you do so, I'm going to allow the prosecution a wider range to rehabilitate her and may threaten him in very subtle ways that are very, very, you know, disturbing to him. So there's different ways of controlling this. There's subtle, less subtle. So I don't know how subtle this judge is, but I'm sure whatever message he has, he's probably got across already, because I see areas where Baez is very, very cautious with the judge, which means that he knows what the judge's reaction is going to be. So, yeah, you, and by the way, you can read judges on this issue, and each one of you will come to your own conclusion before this is over of when the judge hit that line and drew it in the sand. And we're going to revisit this, and I'm sure each one of you is going to say to me when you think it happened. And so everybody watch for that, and everybody look for that moment where you think that tide is turning in the case, and so we can all discuss it later.
Well, okay, I want to change up again. You know, boy, I have more gears in my gearbox. It's been talked about. Baez has moved, I think, at least twice this week for a mistrial. I think that there's also the possibility of a hung jury. What does everyone think? Any possibility of a mistrial or a hung jury? Many.
Snowball's chance in hell. You know, lawyers, you know, that thing makes me laugh more than a lawyer in a criminal case going, I make a motion for mistrial, please.
I think he did it on the first day.
Well, yeah, well, he'll be doing it on his last day, and he'll just keep doing it and doing it. But guess what? You don't win those in criminal trials. As a matter of fact, that's the same as a motion for non-suit in a civil trial. And I think I've won three of those and out of 100 trials, and usually because the other side made an error so large you could drive a, you know, truck through it. So, you know, I just don't see that, especially in a criminal case. You can just forget about it.
Well, does he do it for because he wants to hopefully use this during appeal, that there's a reason for it? I mean, what is it?
Well, it's just something that criminal lawyers do. They just constantly make a motion, you know, to dismiss. And it's funny, when I was a young lawyer, one of the first lessons I was told, look, if a judge says to you A, B, C, and in this case a judge says to you, sit down, counsel, I don't want to hear from you, that's the first indication you're going to win. So you learn certain telltale signs of when you should be heard and when you should not be heard. So what happens is you make these motions, and if a judge agrees with you, he'll go, sit down, counsel, I want to ask the other side some questions. Then you know, hey, my motion's well taken. But until that happens, you have no clue. So he's just sort of feeling the judge out, trying to see what kind of responses he's going to get from this judge and whether they signal a change in the judge's movement. But the reality is they're never granted, and judges, knowing that's what you intend, don't play out their cards. If a young judge, let's say he's been on the bench 3 months, he might say, I can't grant your motion because of A, B, C. Well, that helps the lawyer focus on where his case should be. But, I mean, this judge is very, very experienced. He probably laughs to himself going, oh, he did it again. I mean,
yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Okay. Denny, what do you rate the chances of a mistrial or a hung jury at?
I think I'm with the Manny on this. I think slim to none. I think we're going to have a verdict.
Okay.
And quickly.
Yeah. Simon, can I ask just a quick question while I'm thinking of it?
Certainly.
Some of the chat rooms and so forth I've been in, you know, during the week after the trial, that people talking about it and so forth, some of the, if I want to call them middle of the road, but maybe defense-leaning comments, are that, look, yeah, Casey looked bad, you know, the tapes made her look bad, blah, blah, blah. But really, they didn't prove anything. Yeah, she's a liar. Liars, being a liar doesn't make a killer, and so forth. And, you know, I mean, that's certainly correct. But what my thought was, okay, but it's made Casey into what I think, at least in my opinion, a very despicable person. She's a liar, callous, selfish, and I think that alone, even though, you know, maybe how she conducted herself in these tapes and these interviews weren't smoking gun evidence that she actually killed Kaylee, but I think they're going to serve that Casey is not going to get the benefit of the doubt now, because I think if the people dislike her as a person, don't trust her, and I think even Baez's credibility may have taken a little hit from his opening statement that George, you know, was involved in this since June 16th, and he carried the girl's body out from the pool and all that. So I don't know if I'm right there, but I think it may, these tapes may not have actually shown Casey putting the duct tape over Kaylee's mouth and nose, but I do think it did a lot of good for the prosecution in other areas. Am I wrong on that, or portraying the defendant as a very dislikable person, is that a benefit? I think it is to the prosecution.
Oh, I think that the prosecution has painted a wonderful picture of a despicable young party girl that couldn't give a damn about her small child. Dave, what chance do you see of a mistrial or a hung jury?
None whatsoever. This judge knows what he's doing. He keeps everything in line. He treats the jury with the utmost respect. I mean, I don't think there's going to be anything unless Baez moons the jury, you know, that would lead to a mistrial or anything else. I think the judge is very clear about his objective here, and that is to make sure that Casey get a fair trial. So, no, I don't think there's any chance of it.
All right. Let's play devil's advocate just for a second. Let's pretend that we do end up with a hung jury. And I'm going to disagree with all of the panel and say that it is a possibility. Would Florida go again, you know, based on the economics, the cost, or would they walk away? I'm you know, it's a very hypothetical. Dave, you live in Florida. Would they go again?
Yes, hands down, they would do it, because they've gone this far. They spent a lot of money on it, and in the end, what they are looking for is nothing more than justice. This is a high-profile case, but in the end, it's still just a murder. I don't mean just a murder in that respect. I mean, the press turned it into a high-profile case, and the public bought it. But ultimately, it is a crime against the state of Florida, and that's all that matters.
Okay. Jan is waving at me.
Yeah. My point is that I think that Baez's opening statements would have ruined any chance of them not going for it. In other words, I think now they know they've got it. I mean, his admissions and his opening statements, there's no way that, I mean, I'm sure that they think they can convince a jury that it's not like they say it is.
But if for some reason, you know, there was a mistrial.
Yeah, that with another jury and all that, I think that they would still think it's worth going for it.
Okay. Peter, what's your thoughts? Is it possible that a mistrial or a hung jury situation could arise, and if it does, do you think Florida will take another kick at the cat?
I'd like to agree with Manny and Denny And having said that, I'd like to. I'm not actually agreeing with him. I just want to. Manny had brought up something about, I didn't really understand it, the legal aspect of it, but something where, and this goes with what Denny said, is it possible that so much inflammatory exposure can come through the video and through the despicable lies that the judge could see it that way, where she can't get a fair shake because it's almost like saying she can't get a fair shake because this is who she is. If that doesn't happen, Simon, I predict a incredibly short deliberation for the jury. So I think Manny probably could answer the other one, though.
Yeah. And the other one, no, Simon. The prosecutors, let me put it to you this way. If they didn't prosecute her again, could you imagine the flack they would get?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. I wouldn't want to be in the same state with that prosecutor if they didn't do that. There'll be nowhere for him to hide from that criticism. And that prosecutor knows that.
Uh-huh.
He knows that he's going to get trashed in the morning on the news and in the afternoon and for the rest of his life. And they'll be known as the ones who basically lost the case. And I laugh when I see the prosecutors from the Simpson case on the national news. You know, they were voted trial... Let me tell you a story. They were voted trial lawyers of the year by the L.A. County Bar Association, who felt sorry for them. Do you know that every member of the county bar protested it? Because they said basically they were a bunch of losers. In fact, I remember saying on national TV and in an interview that, you know... Basically, if I, as a taxpayer, I wanted to sue them for malpractice because of their performance as a lawyer. So do you think any of those people would be able to get a job again as a prosecutor? So let's say they left and they moved to California and went to work for the prosecutor's office. They'd be known as the ones who lost the Casey Anthony case.
Mm-hmm.
So you tell
yeah.
me, what kind of career move would that be?
Oh, okay. I want to ask a very hypothetical question. It's something that I mentioned to Jan a couple of days ago. You know, it's easy for us trial watchers. You know, we see things that the jury does not. You know, we've read the depositions. We've heard the pre-trial wrangling. We've seen the smackdowns handed out by Perry, and you know, threats about, you know, at lunch go to your ATM and make sure you have money, because every time you know, you cross me, it's going to be $100. It would have been wonderful to take a man off the street that knew absolutely nothing about this case and have him as a surrogate juror. No one's done it that I know of, but it would have been fascinating. Manny, what do you think the jury is making of the case so far? Yeah, and it's hard to disassociate yourself from, you know, the information that the juror doesn't have.
Well, I don't find it hard at all, Simon, to be very honest with you. I see this the same way that I've said a number of times. There's a presumption in this society that mothers take care of their children. And I don't care where you pull on somebody from, that presumption will be the first thing they said. Wait a minute, this child was missing how long, and what happened while that child was missing? And I just think that will come up every single time, time after time after time, no matter who you ask. You can't escape this. So that's my position is very simple. It doesn't matter who you ask. The first question they're going to respond to is, how long was this child missing without the mother reporting it? I mean, I think that is the most reprehensible thing I have seen as a parent in a long time. And I'm speaking now as a parent, not as a lawyer. So if you take anyone who has a child or had any involvement with a child, whether it's on the child abuse side or a teacher, and almost everybody, grandchildren, very few people are exempt from having any kind of relationship with a child in their life. So first, you would have to find someone who didn't have a child, didn't like children, but fit some unique profile to create some kind of answer that would fit within that those parameters. And it isn't going to happen in the United States. People in this country, if you don't protect your child, you're going to jail. It's really that simple.
Okay, I'm going to get killed if I don't let Jan.
I just wanted to bring up something that could have something to do with this question. But, I mean, in a juror's mind, they see here, they sit and they say, okay, well, all this time, friends have told that they heard of Zanny the nanny. Nobody's seen her, but they still have heard that baby's with the nanny, the baby's with the nanny. And, okay, but what about the times, she said that she's had this nanny for, what, 2.5 years? What about the times that Casey was seen and said that the baby was with the nanny? I mean, they have to ask, well, where was the baby? If the baby wasn't with the grandparents at the time, the baby wasn't with one of her friends at the time,
somebody has to ask, where was the baby? Right.
She did.
She did say that. No, I mean, she did. The Grunge watched her all the time. And
no,
when they weren't watching,
there were times
Cindy
when they didn't have the baby. And there was times when Cindy and George didn't have the baby.
I didn't see any kind of a real breakdown of who had who when. You know,
that's
all
what
I know is that.
No.
Yeah, I mean, if I could pinpoint a particular day where George and Cindy said they didn't have her, the Grunge say they didn't have her, none of her friends say they had her, and Casey didn't have her, then I would say, where was she?
I want to know where was she?
I don't know. I don't know, because I don't know anywhere like where you could actually pinpoint a particular day and not know where she was or know exactly where she wasn't.
Well, don't you think that by now, especially during those 31 days, before they've admitted that the baby was dead, don't you think by now that when everybody says, okay, there is no nanny, don't you think somebody would have said, hey, wait a minute, let me think back. I had the baby that day.
Well, I think the problem with Casey, though, was that she didn't see him every day, and there wasn't any particular day. In other words, if Amy or Ann or Annie or whatever, they all said that they saw her every day, then I could see him questioning, well, does this nanny own the child now?
Right. Okay. We're running a little short on time. Peter, I'm going to put the question to you. We got a little off topic. If you were a juror and you didn't have all of the information that we have, how would you be sitting right now? What would be your position?
It's hard to say because I do have all the information. That's why it was interesting when Mandy said about the thinking there was flesh, because we've been saturated with this for so long. I think I would be looking at Cindy rather favorably, George so-so, Lee so-so, and I think I would be at this point just utterly disgusted with Casey. But it's hard to project that thinking into there, given what we know.
Yeah, it's impossible to unlearn everything that we've learned.
Let me mention something. That goes to your earlier statement about the parameters of the discussion is somebody who hadn't read the depositions, hadn't done this or that. We don't know how much this jury really read on their own or understand on their own. We only know how they answer the questions. We also, so at the end of the day, they may know a lot more about this case than they're letting on right now. So I don't think there could possibly be a virgin jury in this case under the circumstances if they wanted one. So you have to assume they've heard more and they know more.
Oh, indeed. I'll tell you what, we're down to the last few seconds. We're going to lose our live listeners. Don't panic, live listeners. Everything is being recorded, and I'll have a link up shortly. I want to thank our panel, and I'd like to get everyone's final thoughts. Manny, we'll start with you.
Nothing's changed for me. There's still no explanation. This case right now will just move the way it's moving until the defense comes on, because the prosecution has already pretty well proved everything that they need to prove, and they're just going to add gravy and more gravy to the top of this case. And then we're going to have to look for some kind of miracle. And guess what? There won't be one, because there's no miracles in the practice of law. They only happen on Perry Mason and on TV.
Good one. Dave.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, okay, good, because I had been disconnected. Now, what were the quick little question you wanted there answered?
Well, just your parting thoughts. Yeah.
Oh, my parting thoughts are just that in the end, she's going to be found guilty. I don't think the defense has anything, and the state is doing an excellent, excellent job of presenting the facts.
Perfect. And Peter?
Pretty much the same thing. It's going to be a slam dunk with a short deliberation.
Yeah, I agree with Peter there, too. Short deliberation.
Denny, your parting thoughts.
Well, I got to say ditto. I think it's moving along. I'll just be glad personally when the scientific stuff is done, because I really want to see what happens when Baez gets his turn at bat. I want to see where that goes. And I think Manny mentioned maybe, it might have been last week, I think it was Manny, that sometimes, not from the legal sense, but in reality, the burden of proof based after Baez's opening statement may have actually shifted to the defense. And I think if I'm a juror, I'm going to be wanting to see him back up his claims he made in that opening statement. I know he doesn't have to do it from the legal sense, but I'm going to expect it. And he better produce or he's lost his credibility with me.
I like it. And Jan?
I think that Kelly is going to finally get the justice that she needs and deserves. After all this, I think they're going to find her guilty, but I don't think they're going to give her the death penalty.
We need to wrap this up. Unfortunately, we lost TJ and Cobra, but I do want to...
Wait a minute, that's not all bad. Oops.
But I do want to thank them for participating. Till next week. This is Simon and Jan Parrott wishing everyone a happy and safe week. We'll be back again next Sunday, same bat channel, same bat time. Till then, goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all for being here. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.